Gavin Wood's Countdown Podcast, proudly brought to you by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hi, this is David Stowe from Real Life, and you're listening to Gavin Wood's Countdown Podcast.
Send Me an Angel was one of the greatest songs I think I've ever heard. The ultimate pop song, it went all around the world, and it came out of Melbourne from Real Life and David Stowe. I am so happy to be speaking with David Stowe on the Countdown Podcast today. David Stowe is on the line. Hi, David.
Hi, Gavin. It's so nice to be here too. I mean, you're a legend. You know, I grew up with you as a legend, as the voice of Countdown. So every time I hear your voice, it's just such a great pleasure.
Oh, stop it. Oh, I'm supposed to be pumping up your tires.
yeah. But it's, you know, you are the voice of Countdown. You, when you're talking, you're doing your podcast and talking to all these people in bands and stuff, but you're a part of it. You know, you are a part of the sound of the Australian music history. I mean, you think of Countdown, you Molly, and it's your voice and, you know.
Well, it was a great ride for all of us. Now, David Stowe, let's get back to you.
Yes.
Back in the early days, where was that little David Stowe born?
Little David Stowe was born in Footscray Hostibule in 1954.
You're a Footscray boy and you're 2 years younger than me. I hate you.
born in Footscray, grew up in Maribyrnong, Western class, you know, Western suburbs, working class.
Right.
I was absolute crap at school and, you know, Yeah, it wasn't a great place, but anyway, I got through it.
Were you a little distracted at school, do you think? You wanted to get somewhere else? You wanted to do something more interesting?
I was certainly just no good at school subjects. You know, I just, like, failed everything, and I spent my school years looking out the window daydreaming. So, you know, if they have a professorship of daydreaming, I am one. I'm a professor. I can look out the window and just dream of things to this day.
Well, that's what got you where you are today.
I guess so. Yeah, I guess so. Daydreaming. I'm good at it.
So, obviously, school wasn't that important. So, before Real Life and getting that band together, what happened from school in that period between school and Real Life?
I left school, you know, in Form 4. It used to be called Form 4. I don't know what it's called, what that would be now. But, you know, it was pointed out that there weren't many options for me, so I should try to get an apprenticeship. Uh-huh. So I did, and I somehow landed a job in the printing trade.
Right.
And I was called a compositor, a hand compositor, where you, back in the day before Photoshop and everything, where you got one letter and put it into a thing called a form and made up a word upside down, back to front, and made a lead cast of it. And that was my job. I was a compositor. I was called a hand compositor. And there were already things called machine compositor, where someone could sit behind a sort of a typing machine and do the same sort of thing. So, you know, my job was obviously when I started my trade. So I did like 4 years. I had an apprenticeship in a place in Collingwood. You know, I didn't even like that. So I was just a bit lost. Then I did a little bit of music teaching. The place where I was learning guitar decided that they'd have me as a music teacher. So I did a bit of that for a while and didn't really like that either. You know, I don't know what was wrong with me. I just dreamed of doing something else. Never dreamed of being a rock star, though. Never, ever, ever.
So tell me about the music. Was that your escape? Did you pick up the guitar to try and escape your dull, dreary life?
Yeah, of course, of course. I was one of those guys, you know, I was one of those nerds, and there's the old story about, you know, guys joining bands to meet girls, and that was just truly me, you know. I was one of those guys.
All right, now tell me, you're a music teacher at a music school. You're not really, are you teaching guitar?
Yeah, teaching guitar, teaching sort of some lovely people. You know, the people were great, from all sorts of ages, from, you know, teenagers to younger kids, you know. And sadly, some of the younger kids, you know, they'd be given their uncle's guitar that was unplayable and had, you know, wire for strings, and it was like, oh my God.
Weren't they the worst thing, those wires?
And you think that poor kid would be just put off more than anything else, having to try to play their uncle's guitar. It's like, oh God, please go out and buy your kid a guitar.
So you had a natural ability then to play guitar. I mean, guitar is a pretty hard instrument to learn, you know. I mean, you get over your three or four chords, but then when you get into the diminished chords and everything like that, it's pretty intricate. So you must have had a flair for it.
Well, not really. I was sort of I was totally entranced by all the pop music that was around at the time. And when I started like music teaching, I was getting more into the new emerging heavier rock bands like Free and Deep Purple and Man for Man and Led
nice.
Zeppelin.
And I just
mentioned a concert that I went to actually, Deep Purple, Free and Man for Man, because I was talking to a guy about it on the weekend. But you're getting into more of that sort of stuff, and they didn't have the diminished chords. The Beatles did.
Yeah, of course.
But Deep Purple didn't. Or then Led Zeppelin didn't either. But
what bands?
So
are
yeah,
fantastic.
Yeah. So the first concert I went to, I kind of just mentioned it actually, was Free Man for Man and Deep Purple at Festival Hall when I was about 16, in the middle of my apprenticeship before I'd started teaching, and I was like, whoa, what is this stuff? This is amazing.
Yeah.
But I was sort of teaching a bit of kind of classical guitar. There were the AMEB music exams that everyone had to do, and I did a lot of those and was doing some classical guitar, but you know, I'm not terribly gifted as a guitar player. I mean, I try as hard as I can, and I just love great guitar playing, and I kind of fall short to a certain extent in that area, but you know, I do my best.
I'm speaking with David Sterry from Real Life. Now, David, Real Life happened. Did you have a band before Real Life, or was Real Life your first band?
No, I was walking around the playground in Maribyrnong High School sometime in the 60s, and our English teacher came up to me and said, "Sterry, I hear you've been learning guitar." And he went to someone else, and a guy called Tony Scroop. "Tony Scroop, I hear you've been learning drums. Fulvio Cabrera, I believe you think you're a singer. Graham Snell, I believe you're playing bass. You're forming a band. You're playing at the school fete."
Ouch. Okay, the first song you learnt was probably Tin Soldier?
Oh, no, I wish.
Smoke on the Water?
I love that song. No. We named our band Badge.
Nice. After,
which was the Cream song.
Yeah,
the Cream song. Absolutely, yeah. So we didn't know what we were doing, but we managed to play the school fete, and it was like, wow, why didn't we think of doing this before? And so, but it was our English teacher put us together and said, okay, you're a band.
Well, that's brilliant.
Yeah, it was great. It was no one else would ever have thought of it, but this English teacher said, oh, you're doing this. Why don't you play a band?
Yeah,
join a band. So
yeah.
We did.
Well, thank God.
Great. So,
thank God for the English teacher. Have you sent him any royalties?
No. Well, I didn't get any, Gavin.
Mate, he started your career in bands.
Yes, I know.
So after Badge, what happened?
After Badge, gee, I just was doing, you know, I left school and started my apprenticeship, and was just maybe played in a band that was looking to do weddings or something or anything. It was just a covers band thing. I can't even remember what it was called. Mm-hmm. So it was really about 1975 or 70. I know that I'd played in a band with all the former members of Kush for a while called Vehicle. And we kind of had a residency. Mm-hmm. At a hotel on a Thursday night, and it was pretty amazing for me playing with all those guys, because they'd been in Kush before. Mike Brady was the singer for a while, and I was like, you know, 18 years old or something, and it was, you know, really exciting. And then in about 1977, I think, I got a phone call and said, hey, Kush is reforming, would you like to play guitar? And I said, yes, of course. So I joined Kush for a little while, for about 3 months or something, as long as that lasted, and played some fun gigs with some great people. They were great musicians, those guys. Boy, were they good. And I loved all that old stuff, you know, Chicago and Blood, Sweat and Tears and Joe Cocker stuff that they played. So that was a real learning experience. When these guys were actual professional, seasoned musicians that I'd heard of and watched as I was growing up, seeing them on TV and things. So it was a pretty amazing thing for me, yeah. It's good.
So now you're a semi-professional guitarist.
Yep.
What happens next?
Boy, I just kind of stopped teaching, and I started falling through the cracks, and was on the dole and doing just any sort of part-time work I could. I didn't really have any ambition because I was like I was like about 22 or 23, and I thought, oh, you know, I'm way too old to kind of, you know, have my own musical career. And I think there was something about me wanting to write songs somewhere, and I'd never gone down that track before, thinking, you know, I'm not going to be a virtuoso musician. I'm not a great, incredibly good guitar player, but I'd like to write some songs.
Yeah.
And one day there was a knock at my door, and some young guy had come around with the Age newspaper, and there was an ad for a synthesizer player. And I was very interested in these new synthesizer sounds. I love the sounds of, you know, MySex started it for me. It was like, you know, hearing computer games, like, whoa, what is that sound? You know, what's going on there?
Mm.
And I thought, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a great song.
That's a big song.
And so anyway, there was this ad in the Age newspaper from a synthesizer player who wanted to meet a guitar player with a view to write songs. It wasn't about forming a band. And that was from Richard Zatorski.
Dear Richard.
And this young friend of mine said, David, you've got to ring this number. You have to. This is you.
Yeah.
And I'm going, nah, maybe. But anyway, I finally made the call. And, of course, you know, that changed my life and Richard's, of course, as well.
I still remember Richard's big smile when he was on stage.
Yeah.
He just looked like he loved every bit of it, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. But we weren't going to be a band. We were just going to write songs possibly for other people. And then we're just trying to learn to write. And then Richard sort of said, oh, come on, let's get a band together. And I went, oh, okay, I'm a bit old, but I think I was about 25 or 26 or something. And I went, okay, we'll do that. So that's where Real Life started. And we sort of found a bass player and we went out with a drum machine and played our first songs. We were sort of more punk, I think, than anything else then. But we
New wave, probably.
Yeah, new wave, yeah. Yeah, we played everything at 100 miles an hour and with a little drum machine. And David Briggs from LRB listened to one of our demo tapes once and he said, you know, it's incredibly un-Australian of you not to have a drummer.
Yeah.
It's just not the done thing.
Right.
So we had to find a drummer and we found Danny and that was the beginning of it.
Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives since 1934. Visit tobinbrothers.com.au.
Hi, this is David Stowe from Real Life, and you are listening to Gavin Wood's Countdown Podcast.
Semi and Angel.
Yep.
You wrote that song.
Yep.
And you impressed Glenn Wheatley so much, he formed his own record company called Wheatley Records on the strength of the song.
That's right, pretty much, yeah.
He had a big vision. He believed in you guys. So
yeah,
how did you meet Glenn and how did all that happen?
I think it was pretty much via Jeffrey Shoecraft, really.
Dear Jeffrey. Okay.
Yeah, Jeffrey was working for Glenn Wheatley and we were, at the time, one of the hottest unsigned bands around Melbourne. You know, we were just playing loads. Because we'd have 2,000 people at the Chevron on a Tuesday night without a record, without anything on the radio, nothing. We just...
I remember.
One of those bands.
Mm.
And I think Jeffrey had seen us, and you know, the business was changing. You know, there was the era of the Little River Band was sort of changing to this new wave punk kind of thing, and Jeffrey was out scouting around, and Gudinski was as well. So Jeffrey was scouting for Wheatley and going, look, there's this band called Real Life, and you know, so they were all. I don't think Gudinski or Glenn Wheatley really liked a lot of that music, you know, because it was like just we were turning everything on its head from what it was before.
Mm.
And but they needed to, they sort of felt like they needed to sign something new, whether they liked it or not. They could see there was something changing and Real Life was a part of that scene. And so I think Jeffrey Shoecraft had sort of said, look, Glenn, here's a band, you know, you should sign them for a publishing contract. So we had a meeting with Glenn Wheatley about publishing, and about 2 days later, he sort of rang up and said, look, I want to manage you guys. And
yeah,
it was like, whoa.
That's great.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, and that was a big thing because Glenn had taken bands to America and broken them. I mean, he had this international thing, whereas at the time, Michael Gudinski didn't really have that Nothing on Mushroom had really cracked it internationally, whereas Wheatley had this whole experience. And I think every band at that time, by the 80s, knew that they had to kind of break out of Australia because the population just, we didn't have, you know, you'd have a gold record, but that was only 30,000 copies. didn't pay for your video or your album.
There's only so many times you can do the Wagga Wagga Bowls Club.
Absolutely. And as much as I love the Wagga Wagga Bowls Club, you know, you can't do it. So I think everyone was aware of having to somehow break out of Australia and try to, you know, make that big transition to somewhere overseas, whether it was England or Europe or America. So, yeah, that was what happened.
So how lucky are you guys? You've signed with Glenn Wheatley for publishing and also management. And now he's tipped you into Curb Records in America and MCA Records, the mother company, as well for everything outside Australia. That's a great deal.
It wasn't because of what happened in the end when Wheatley Records was bankrupt. And our contract said we could only audit Wheatley Records ever. And we couldn't, you know, so when that was liquidated, we were sort of in deep trouble and couldn't get any accounting from our international distributors. Was a bit of a big mess. It took a long time to sort that out. But it's also a conflict of interest, Gavin, in that, you know, if we were in trouble with our management, our record company couldn't tackle our manager, or our manager couldn't tackle our record company, or our record company couldn't tackle our publisher, because they're all the same person.
A big mess. Okay, well, let's talk about the album Heartland, because really that was the debut album and the biggest one for you. I mean, what an album. What was that, 5 years of writing songs all on that album or more?
Probably about 3 years, actually. Yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, we formed in 1980, and it took us till in 1983 we recorded Semi and Angel and the Heartland album. So it was like 3 years of kind of, we didn't even play for the first year. It was just Richard and I trying to write songs and get that part of it together. So really, yeah, it was about, you know, 3 years to the Heartland album.
Right. Well, Catch Me I'm Falling is on that album as well, which is another big real-life song. But Semi and Angel, of course, topped the charts in New Zealand and Germany. Top 40 in the US, and the album was widely well received too. You guys must have thought, man, away we go. And also was it 83?
83 was Angel, yeah. 83 was Angel and Heartland, yeah.
And then you won the Countdown Award. Heartland won the Best Debut Album Award.
We got two, yeah.
And then you also won the Most Promising New Talent in 1983. So 1983 must be your biggest year in your life.
Well, it was actually more like 84, because we finally toured America in 84 with Eurythmics in Berlin. And then halfway through that tour, Angel went to number one in Germany. So it was 84 was when it was like number one for a month in Germany.
Wow.
And also at the same time, Catch Me was in the top 10 as well over this. We had like two songs in the top 10 in Germany, which is like, woo!
Yeah,
I think for any band having two songs in the top 10 as well. Yeah, so yeah, big years and a lot of traveling for us. You know, playing in New Zealand, playing in America, playing in Germany. We were supposed to be on tour with Eurythmics for like 3 weeks or something, and you know that turned out to be like 4 or 5 months because we were following Angel jumping up the charts all over the world.
Right. Well, in 85, you released Flame, your second studio album. How did that go for you?
It completely stiffed.
Well, at least you're honest.
What a disaster. Really? Oh, look, it had some, it was one of the worst times of my life, I think, making the record. We were just lost. But in retrospect, there's some things that you go, but that was really good. But that was really good. And that was really good. Yeah. And there are some really good things on it that just were, smothered by trying to replicate Send Me an Angel, which was like an impossible thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it just took too long, cost a lot of money, and we were sort of off the scene for like the Australian scene, particularly for almost like 12 months or something.
Right.
And, you know, that was just sort of unforgivable. So it went down the gurgler and so did we to a certain extent. It was like a disaster.
It's the old classic case, isn't it? You get your record deal and then all those songs you've been writing for the last 3 or 4 years and honed into beautiful songs, they go on the album and then it gets released and is successful, and then the record company says, we need another album and we need it now.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then
yeah,
you've got exactly to go, oh, God, we've got to write another 12 songs. How are we going to do
yeah.
that? You know, and,
absolutely,
and,
yeah.
And physically and mentally, you know, you
and we're exhausted. We've been touring. Yeah, we've been touring for so long. It's not as though none of us were ever like best friends or anything. We were more like a band that, you know, got together to sort of, you know, be successful. There was never like huge friendships within the band.
Mm.
And yeah, and that's exactly what happened. I mean, there are some really good songs on there. Face to Face is a great song. That was the only kind of like release as a single, but we'd also kind of grown in another direction. It was more of an album. The song Flame itself is just one of the favorite things we've ever written. You know, I think it's one of Richard's musical masterpieces.
Right.
And it's a beautiful, gorgeous song. You know, I love it. And I put it in there. We also, back to the Heartland album, our second single was a song called Open Hearted, which stiffed completely. But I love it so much. So I've always got Open Hearted and Flame in the set, even though they're kind of like albatrosses around my neck. But I love them.
You and Richard wrote some brilliant songs. What I like doing in this podcast is actually turning people on to those albums that people missed when they had their first run through. And then they go, oh, real life, let's get back into the catalogue. You know, I did that with Grace Knight and the Eurogliders. You know, they've got a whole depth of great albums. And I went back and listened to them all. And it was the best journey I ever took. And I loved it. So now I'm excited, and I know the listeners to this podcast will be excited to go back and listen to those albums again, because there's lots of gems in there.
You.
Now, we move from Flame, and in 86, Down Comes the Hammer, which is the US release, and that also contained songs from your previous albums, and it seems like a pattern that Americans do, you know.
They put Send Me an Angel on every bloody record we released if they could.
Yeah, of course. Well, and, mate, it's a big song, that's why.
I know, but you kind of need to move on. So we had a song in America that we'd sort of recorded for a film called Babies.
Okay.
And that was flying up, you know, you're very aware of what K-Rock was to the Americans back in the day.
Huge.
My good mate Richard Blades getting a star on the Hollywood Boulevard, by the way, very soon. Yeah,
good.
He is. Yeah. So all of a sudden, you know, we had this sort of, we'd recorded something for a film called Babies, and we'd recorded a couple other tunes, and became Down Come the Hammer. Because Richard left the band, Steve Williams was the new guy in the band, and we just needed sort of, you know, something to get out there. So we released this tune, Babies, and it just sailed into the K-Rock charts. It was, you know, top 10 in K-Rock and 91X in San Diego. And we thought, yeah. And it's also a bit tougher for us. It's this kind of, you know, anti-war song.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, the Wheatley Records was released via BMG here. And BMG said, no, we can't release that.
Oh.
It's called Bleeding Babies. You can't release that. And
change,
we're going, hey, we're top 10 in on K-Rock with this song. Wouldn't, you know, all your other bands on BMG Australia would love to be, you know, any of your artists on top 10 on K-Rock. Oh, no, we can't release that.
Oh,
so that was kind of beginning. That was the first nail in a coffin for a certain extent for a while. So, you know, and the local stations, the Triple M's and the Foxes would say, oh, no, we heard you breaking up. No, we're top 10 in K-Rock in America.
Oh, dear. So you needed a hot publicist back here in Australia to keep the fire burning.
Well, I guess, but they were kind of hamstrung too. It was like, okay, so you've got this top 10 in America and your record company here won't release it? What the hell's going on? What's that all about? You know, it's we had John Farnham on backing vocals on that. Jeez.
And get into show business?
Bloody hell.
Yeah. Now, you released Send Me an Angel 89.
Yep.
And that when that single was released, it got higher in the US charts than the original Send Me an Angel. How good was that?
Yes.
Albatross.
Albatross.
Yeah. Was there a drum beat sequence happening, or did you over phase it, or what was different?
No, okay. So about that time, New Order, one of my all-time, you know, ever influential favorite songs is Blue Monday by New Order.
Great song.
Yes,
great
absolutely.
Song.
Yeah. So there was an American remix by Michael Jackson's producer. Quincy Jones. Yeah. Quincy Jones remixed Blue Monday. Can you believe that?
Wow. Okay.
And it was kind of a hit all over again. And as much as I love the original Semi Angel, I always thought, I wish Trevor Horn had done it or something, you know, that a version. And I spoke that over loudly to the record company, and they went, oh, that's a good idea. What about a remix?
We can make some money.
Yeah. So they sent it to an English guy called Nigel Wright, who had a band called Shack Attack. Nigel was the keyboard player for Shack Attack. Uh-huh. And he did a remix, and once again, Curb Records were farting through silk.
Sorry? What was that last line again? I missed that. Curb Records were
farting through silk, yeah.
Farting through silk.
Yeah, which means they had a hit record on their hands, yeah.
Is that a common terminology? I've never heard of that.
I've said that to people before. You know, stick with me and you'll be farting through silk. It's, you know, something you say.
Maybe, David,
you don't. So you've never heard that one before, Gavin.
I can't believe that. Mate, I've been around a bit, but I've never heard that one.
you've never suggested that to a beautiful young lady or anything?
Oh, before? David, now we're going into another area completely. Hang on, get the train back on the track. Here we go.
Sorry, Gavin.
No, that's all right, mate. Yeah. I love it. Throw them in when you can, I say.
Yes.
Now, after that single was released, we go right to 1990.
Yep.
And your third studio album, Lifetime.
Yep.
And this time you were so upset, you were just going to have all new material on this album. So how did it work for you?
Well, in some cases, we were lucky enough to have, for half the album, Steve Hillage, who produced the Heartland album, come out to Australia and work with us.
Okay.
And then we were halfway through making Lifetime when Angel became a hit. And we had to sort of down tools and head off to America and do a bit of a tour. But so after that, the Americans decided, okay, well, let's get this Nigel Wright guy on board to do the other half of the album because he'd done the remix of Semi and Angel. So God Tonight was a K-Rock hit over in America. And Wheatley Records had pretty much gone by then. Mm-hmm. And we were signed directly to Curbs for that one. So we were like an international band in Australia. So we were signed to an international label, not an Australian label.
Mm-hmm.
BMG, I know, but BMG was supposed to release it and look after it. And they just went, there's a new Farnham album out. So we'll work that instead.
Okay.
So God Tonight, which is, you know, one of our, you know, best tunes ever, I think.
Mm.
Once again was, you know, K-Rock hit in America and blazing up the charts, and yeah, just wasn't given a priority here, so it went down the Googler. But we also from that album there was a song called Kiss the Ground that was a club hit in America.
Mm.
But yeah, so it was a very respectable album as far as the critics thought. Anyway, they thought, okay, Real Life are back on track, there's some great songs here, but you know, they're not going to have a hit record. And also grunge was breaking out at that time too. So
right.
All of a sudden, you know, we're in Seattle and playing in Seattle and there's a band called Nirvana and Pearl Jam.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, and also the funny thing was with America too, God Tonight, the single, it's got a little bit of a spoken part at the end. I wouldn't dare call it rap, but it says, to hell with money, to hell with guns, to hell with poverty, death and drugs, to hell with hell, to hell with hate, to hell with fear, to hell with AIDS. And the first Gulf War broke out, and that whole sentence was seen as un-American.
They're very straight, the Americans.
Oh, yeah, yeah. To hell with money, to hell with guns. Oh, hello.
Yeah, I know.
America.
I know.
So, I know you do.
Mm. So, tell me about after Lifetime and that success of those singles and the respect that you got, the band broke up again.
We've never broken up. There's been hiatuses, I would say. There was never a breakup.
Okay.
Yeah, hiatus, where you go, look, we're in so much legal shit with our record companies that there's just, God knows, there's no way out of this, and you can't, we can't record, we can't do this, we can't do that. And what's the point anyway? There's no coming back from this. But at some stage, you kind of go, well, look, it turns out that my life was spent being a songwriter and a singer in a band called Real Life. And so no matter what, I mean, there's a new record out at the moment called Sirens that I put out last year. Yeah. And it's basically me, but I'm still calling it Real Life because no one knows who David Stirrer is. He's the singer, you know, Real Life is my brand. Yeah. And I still sound that way. I still sound, no matter what I do, I can't sound like anyone else, and I can't write like anyone else. So me is me, and that is Real Life.
You'll always be introduced as David Stirrer from Real
Life. From Real Life, absolutely.
Now, mate, you know, with all the money and the legal problems and everything like that, I got very friendly with a good mate of mine who's David J. Holman, who's a record producer up in the Hollywood Hills at Cactus Studios.
Lovely, lovely, lovely man. Yes, David Holman.
He told me he had a Swedish singer came in, a Swedish band came in, and they were recording a couple of tracks. And halfway through the recording, the lead singer just said, that's it. I'm out of here. And David kind of, you know, followed him down the stairs and, what's up, mate? Can I help you? And da-da-da-da-da. And he said, I was just in the studio there thinking, I owe $1 million to the record company.
Yeah.
And I'll never pay it back. I'm giving it up. You know, it's such a hard business, isn't it?
Yeah, but who was that guy? Who was it? There's a punchline here, Gavin, isn't
it? No, there's no punchline because David doesn't tell, you know, doesn't give names or anything like that. And I didn't ask or anything like that. He just said it was one of the saddest days of his life to see this singer, who was a great singer, apparently.
But
the business crushed him.
But, you know, that's this. I mean, was it 2005, the first Countdown Tour? Was that what the big concert thing?
Yes, yeah.
Okay. But just sitting around with all those, what an amazing, you know, collection of people, you know, the history of Australian music and also people like Leo Sayer. Yeah. And, you know, we'd be sitting around the fireside late at the hotel and you'd all relating stories. And we'd all been in that situation where we just thought it was all hopeless. You know, we owed the record company so much bloody money. Mm. And, you know, just amazing stories. And for me, that was great because I thought I was the only idiot in the music industry that had lost everything and not made anything and been stuck with, you know, bad contracts and stuff. But hearing everybody else say the same thing, it was like, oh, God, thank God it's not just me.
Now, your fourth studio album, Happy. On the back of that, you toured America, Germany, and Australia. So, how was that received?
Received well, and that was our first album where we were just like completely independent.
Uh-huh.
It was also a little bit before iTunes and YouTube. There was the internet and that, but this was early stages, and we thought, we can't go through that kind of crap again. So we're just going to make our own album. No one's going to tell us what they want to hear from us. We're just going to be angry and. and be more like we are live. So no, it was great. It was fantastic. Got a lot of, you know, great reviews saying, you know, why I realized so angry, but it's a fantastic album. And I remember ringing up, you know, having to do the radio calls, the cold calls in America for the radio station managers. And it would be 3 a.m. here in Melbourne. You'd ring up someone in Texas and go, oh, you know, I'm David from Real Life, blah, blah. And the guy go, oh, shit, I was just on the phone to Prince, you know.
Yeah.
And you'd go, you know, I just got to talk about my album for a second. And they'd go, well, look, you know, the number one record on a station at the moment is the song from the Titanic, whatever it is.
Celine Dion.
So obviously we're not going to be playing your album Happy, but it is the most played album in the office of the station at the moment. Everyone's playing it in the background. So
really?
I thought, yay! Yeah. So I thought that was really good. Going independent, you know, was a big decision because there's no budget and there's no management and there's no producers and there's no studios. But it was a great decision, you know, and you just, you know, why would anyone want to go back to that thing with a record company? Ugh.
Well, these days, of course, your fifth studio album, Send Me an Angel, 80s Synth Essentials, through Cleopatra Records. It was that released just in the States?
they have a worldwide license for it. But the interesting thing about that was the guy from Cleopatra, he sort of started out selling band T-shirts and then formed a label and signed up. And, you know, he realized the miserable state for a whole lot of artists who were just kind of stuck and couldn't make records anymore. He'd offer people, he'd go, hey, you know, hey, I'll give you X amount of dollars to make a cover album, including one of your records, because 5 years after you've recorded a hit song, you're completely allowed to re-record it. No matter what any record company says, you're allowed to re-record your biggest hit records if you want to.
Yeah.
And so he sort of found that. He said, okay, how about you make a record of your favorite 80s songs that include Send Me an Angel there, and we'll give you X amount of money, which was enough to buy a brand new top-of-the-range Macintosh computer plus some really cool monitors. And I was never done much production or engineering myself.
Right.
And so, you know, my heart's going, yeah, yeah, yeah. But my brain's going, no, you idiot. Of course you can't do that. So I said, yes.
Yeah.
So I said, yes. And I got the money for a new computer in the advance and the speakers. And I sat downstairs learning this program called Logic. And I was one lesson ahead of myself on Logic while I was recording this record,
right,
doing this cover. So I kind of learned to record and produce myself via that happy experience of making that cover album.
Good on you. And why yes. not? You know, sometimes
why not?
Sometimes you have to sell out.
Sometimes you have to sell out, but it was like, you know, I was just flying by the seat of my pants, learning how to do all this stuff that was just way out of my, you know, my range.
That's cool.
But it worked out. You've grown.
Now,
and Cleopatra Records, I tell you what, I made more out of that. They pay royalties.
Nice.
Yeah, and they account to you on time. I actually just banked a check this morning from them, so that's still going after all these years, and it's, you know, a nice little earner. Yeah.
Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hi, this is David Sterry from Real Life, and you are listening to Gavin Wood's Countdown Podcast.
Now, last year, we briefly touched on it, your new album, Sirens. Tell me all about that, because, you know, I've been away and I don't know anything about this one. All new songs?
Yeah. So, of course, interestingly, Sirens comes out in a pandemic.
Well, why not?
And
it's perfect.
Yeah, why not? Oh, yeah. So, you know, I'd been touring, you know, with America, and I got to play Adelaide last Friday, as you know, but that was my first gig since playing in Germany in February of 2020. So, I've been grounded. And the album came out last year, and I wanted to make a proper old-fashioned album that I grew up with. When I remember going, someone back in the day, you know, when Sergeant Pepper's came out, and you'd go around to your friend's place who had the best stereo.
Yeah.
Their mum would make you a cup of tea and some scones, and you would sit there and you would pore over the album, read every word on the cover, and discuss what you thought about it afterwards. And I thought, oh, those were the days.
And there were
like concept the album things. So me being what's called very proudly a new wave band, where we, you know, use synthesizers proudly and guitars as well,
yeah,
I thought, okay, I'm going to make a new wavy concept-y album. And I've always been fascinated by, you know, the ancient history of Greece and Rome and all those things, and Egypt and things. The Sirens, I thought, yeah, Sirens. So I wanted to do a thing like Metal by Pink Floyd, or Low by David Bowie, where, you know, one side is just a concept kind of track, but doing this in a new wave style. So one side of the album is called Sirens, and it's about, you know, once again, it's the usual tragic story of somebody who wanted to hear the sirens sing and came to a sad ending, I guess, in the way. So I thought, okay, but that's really good, because then I only have to write one long song. I'm a lazy bastard, and it means I don't have to write 10 songs. If one song is one side, that'll be good. So, yeah, I had this thing with sirens, but then I had to make the sirens sing, didn't I, as well? So I've got to have a part where the sirens sing. From the safety of your own lounger, you're not going to die if you listen to this. You know, you hear the sirens, but you don't have to sort of drown or anything.
Right.
And there's a little bit where the aliens try to rescue, you know, there's aliens in there.
Sounds like War of the Worlds.
Yeah, it is a little bit, yeah. But it was, you know, the good thing is there's no record company, there's no manager, there's no going, David, no, you have to do this. I'm going, nah, king's ass, I can do whatever I bloody well want.
Good on and, you.
And make a record that I'm going to laugh at and enjoy and have fun writing and recording.
Well done.
And so I did. So Sirens is the one side, and on the other side is I wanted to write five kind of bangers that I just love to play live that are going to kick ass. And I got to play a couple of them last year in Germany. And as you know, I'm standing on stage in you know, Berlin going, okay, now we are going to play a new song. And you see everybody's face dropping. Oh, God.
Yeah.
What's he going to do? And, you know, we've got a song on the record called My Beautiful Monster, which is about my battle with depression and anxiety like everybody else in the world.
Yeah.
And it starts out kind of sad and then becomes this fabulous, uproarious, stomper, dancey thing. And so we started out, you know, My Beautiful Monster, and it's the slow start. Then all of a sudden the chorus kicks in and just the whole audience's faces light up every night. It's like, ah, it's okay.
We can dance. We can.
He's got a new
down.
Song. He's got a new song, but it's good.
Yeah, that's great. Now tell me, in this world of technology and Spotify and Apple iTunes and everything like that, are all your songs on all the platforms so that our listeners can get in there and really get into it and buy a few things?
Yes, they are. But also with Sirens, one of the things I did was I decided I'm going to press CDs because back on tour in that German tour just before the shutdown, I had download cards. I was in the process of getting CDs made and vinyl, but I had download cards, and everyone goes, oh, you know, you're giving someone, you know, like a year of your life, and they can't be bothered. They go,
it's a code.
But it's also on. I have a Shopify store, so Sirens is on CD and on vinyl. There's only 300 vinyl copies, but it's double gatefold. It's the best quality vinyl you can get, and there's lots of little things written all over the record. There's lots of lies, tricks, and jokes embedded in the cover.
So where do I get it? Tell me.
Shopify. It'll be Real Life Store, Shopify, whatever the thing is.
So if you just put in Shopify...
Yeah, probably if you just put Shopify...
Google Shopify, it'll take you there. Okay.
Shopify Real Life.
Okay.
Real-Life Australia, myshopify.com.
Well, that's easy.
Yeah, isn't it?
One of my greatest pleasures when I lived in LA was
going to the Cat and Fiddle with Meek.
I was going to say that.
And the Cat and Fiddle's not there anymore.
It's not. They knocked it down, the buggers. But
they moved somewhere, but it sounds like it's crap.
Yeah. But when I heard David Sterry's in town, we hooked up and I said, we've got to catch up. And it was a great afternoon, man. And it was good to see you and continued success. I'm a big fan of you and the concept and you know, the new wave synth pop of real life and your journey. It just doesn't stop, and that's what I like about you. You know,
thanks, Kevin.
I'll never retire, and I don't think you will ever retire.
No, I'm
either.
Not going to. I know. Good you man. Know, it's funny. Music is more important to me than anything else at the moment. You know, getting old, and we're living with. In a pandemic, and you know, God knows what can happen. And you know, like you and I, we're losing so many dear friends from the music business all the time. You know, there's not a week goes by where, you know, someone's not ill or we've lost somebody. So you know, it's try to make as much music you can, or play as many gigs as you can. It's no longer about money or being famous. It's just trying to sort of make some music and. I hopefully see some smiling faces out there in the audience.
Yeah.
That's what it's about.
Yeah, that's what it is. Well, mate, continued success. You've always been a great mate of mine, and I've been a fan, and when you think about it, we have been mates for 41 years. You know, it's a long time.
I know. Yeah, absolutely.
A long time.
It is.
So I've got the top 10 countdown podcast questions to ask you. To wrap up this great podcast, and I thank you so much for your time. I really do.
Thank you, Gavin.
So, first question. Who inspired you to make music?
I guess David Bowie.
Yeah.
Like so many other people, you know, That man came along, and I was already a fan of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, but David Bowie came along and did something absolutely different, and kept doing difference all his life. So him for sure, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Second question: What have you learnt over your musical journey?
I've learned to just embrace music as my life, in that I've never fancied myself as a great musician like a Beatle or a Stone or a David Bowie or anything, but it's just the same. Making music is not a waste of time, is not a waste of your life, and that's what I've embraced. Music has brought that to me, and I'm in love with it more than I ever have been in my life.
What was the effect of Countdown to your career?
All the checkout chicks in the supermarket knew who I was.
That's the best answer.
I was just this dork that was in there every day, and then all of a sudden, you walk in on that Monday morning and it's like, whoa. I mean, the whole town knows who you are. Everybody knows, but it was especially the checkout chicks.
Oh, that's astounding. I love that. Mate, if you could open up a show for any artist, who would it be?
David Bowie, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, David. Oh, a lot of bands, David Bowie, or the Beatles, or the Stones, or anyone. Yeah. The interesting thing, in 2009, in touring America and playing the Greek Theatre, was Ringo was there the night before. We were always one night behind Ringo Starr.
Damn.
And everyone, we'd walk out on the stage and go, Jesus, Ringo was here last night. Can I smell anything?
So, mate, name three dinner guests, dead or alive.
So I'm a bit of a history buff, yeah. I'm fascinated by the Queen. I think she's an amazing woman. Boy, the stories she could tell about all the prime ministers, Winston, and growing up through all those years during the war.
Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah, or, all those, and apparently she's a very funny woman as well, and she loves a joke, and apparently she impersonates people.
Oh.
So, yeah. Absolutely love to have her there. From the music world, John Lennon, be pretty incredible to have John Lennon there. And I've got one more, haven't I?
Yep.
I think Picasso would be an amazing man.
Ooh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, a bit of royalty, a bit of art, and the works.
We'll put the four of you at a dinner table at McDonald's, and away you go. Now, what's your favourite song to perform?
Oh, Send Me an Angel, of course. It was amazing playing in Adelaide, three nights ago, and it was my first gig in like 16 months, and I was nervous. And I guess Adelaide has done pretty well with all the lockdown stuff, and they weren't wearing masks and they were dancing together.
Yeah.
And, as soon as they hear the opening notes of that song, they go apeshit and they sing it for me pretty much. And, never, ever, ever. And I often say that at the end of the song. I tell people, hey, I'm never, ever going to get sick of singing that, as long as you get that reaction. So, it's just such a privilege to have something. That, for 3.5 minutes you're looking out and there's just absolute happiness in the middle of a pandemic on all these people's faces, it's good. What a privilege.
Well, a song, a big hit like that takes you around the world, and it does for you because
it does.
You do lots of shows all around the world.
Yeah, and I love it when I go somewhere where they don't speak English and your life is in danger, like Lima, Peru or something.
Ooh.
Where, you're advised, do not go out. Yeah. Do not get in a taxi. And they don't have much English, but the night we played in Lima, they deafened me with their vocals. They were louder than the band. They sang it word for word, deafeningly loud.
How good.
And then you try to have a conversation afterwards.
Nothing. that's hot. Mate, speaking of trouble, what's the most trouble you've ever gotten into?
Oh, record contracts.
Yeah. Isn't it great you don't have to worry about those now? You can do it all on social media and sell records that way. It seems so easy and clean, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yes, it is. It's still a complicated area, copyright and all those things. Record contracts.
If you could change anything about the music industry, what would you do?
I'd make sure every young musician has a degree in law and accounting before they sign anything. So, because it's a very complicated area, and you know, things like Shopify, I mean, it's kind of like Uber. They came along and didn't seem to have any mandate to do anything, but they just sort of took over the record business like Apple. And, you know, the record companies and the traditional owners of the music were left floundering because they just didn't see it coming.
Yeah.
And, you know, even to this day, copyright's an evolving situation. They're always trying to, you know, take as much off you as they can, and you know, make you earn less or make your rights last less longer. So yeah, those things are very important for young musicians especially.
Okay, question number 9, what's the best show that you've ever done?
Okay, this is fantastic. It was 1998 in Chicago in America. We were over there on tour, and we got to Chicago, and we got picked up at the airport by these young kids who'd booked the show. They were promoting the show, and they were really quite young. And they said, "Oh, real life, you know, wow, we're so happy to see you. We're promoting the show tonight at a beautiful theater in Chicago. We're going to pick you up in the biggest limousine. You're staying in the best hotel in Chicago, picking up the biggest limousine. Here's a flagon of bourbon. Here's a flagon of vodka. So we hear you like that stuff."
These guys are good. I like their style.
Dropped us off at our hotel and said, "We're going back to school. We'll see you later."
No.
Yeah. And sure enough, you know, at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the biggest limousine in Chicago comes to the best hotel in Chicago to pick us up to take us to sound check, which is in this really wild, rough Hispanic area in Chicago. And there were cops throwing people over the bonnets of cars outside the theater and stuff. We went, "Oh my God," you know, it was pretty intense. And we got into this big old theater, and there was problems with the fire marshals. They were saying, "Oh, you know, we're not sure this place is safe, you know, blah, blah, blah." We're standing on an empty stage and going, you know, okay, so where's all the equipment? Where's the amps, and where's the drum kit?
Yeah, have you got a lighting rig?
Oh yeah. and they're going, "Oh, look, our uncle's coming in a minute with the equipment." So their uncle had a bit of a mariachi band or something.
Oh no.
And he had two daggy little lamps and a shitty little drum kit. And we went, "Oh no." Put us in the best hotel with the biggest limo, and they've got this crap. Yeah. And the interesting thing was, they were lovely kids, but they weren't there for Send Me an Angel. It was all about God Tonight was their big hit, you know, because it was a newer generation and they wanted to hear that. So we do a basic sound check and come back to the gig, and we come back and we have to go through metal detectors at our own gig, which was pretty impressive. And one of them has an uncle who's an off-duty police officer who's on stage with me, with his gun in his holster, walking around, because they thought, you know, something had happened. And I've never felt so loved by an audience in my whole life. You know, these kids were great, but there's this guy beside me with a gun all the time, and I just wanted to stage dive. For the first and only time in my life.
Yeah.
And this gig was just going off. It was fantastic. And then we get to the big song, God Tonight, for them. And we get halfway through it, and the power blows out.
Mm.
And there's nothing. And it's like, oh, no. And it finally comes back on. We say, okay, we're gonna start God Tonight again, because we know it's your favorite song. And we get halfway through it again, and the power goes out again. And third time lucky, we got through it. Got through the show. It was, and the kids who promoted the show were like in tears because everything had happened. And we go, "No, that was the best show of our lives. It was just so exciting and so much fun, and the people were beautiful."
Yeah.
And it was fantastic.
How many people at the gig? How big was the room?
Oh, I think it was a couple of thousand. It was great.
Okay.
It was a big gig, and with this small equipment.
you would have felt like the Beatles at Shea Stadium.
Oh, it was just it was amazing. It was just, for some reason, everything went wrong, but everything was so right about everything going so wrong. We had a ball. I'll never forget it. It was the most beautiful night.
Well, the good thing is you can talk about it. It's a great story.
Yeah, I didn't get shot.
Final question, David Sterry from Real Life.
Yes.
What have you learnt, and what would you pass on to a young, hopeful David Sterry?
boy, oh boy, don't give up on your dreams. You know, you can have a career in music without being an incredible virtuoso or a Beatle or a Madonna or something. You can, you know, have a lot, have a life in the music business. The money is in the songwriting. Be very careful with all the legal documents. Don't just sign anything because you want to be famous or have a contract, or you or your manager's famous and you think you can trust him. But don't give up dreaming, you know. Just dream on. There's a song on our new album called Dream On. Yes.
Well, oh, there you go.
Well, Sirens.
Well, mate, you've got a great body of work. I can't wait to get back into the real life musical journey and listen to all those things I missed because you and I were both travelling too fast back in the 80s.
We certainly were, Gavin. We certainly were. Mate, but we're still here. Isn't that good? It's good that you're here and, yeah. You know, and yeah.
Well, mate, we're in the best country in the world now. Don't you think?
We certainly are.
Yeah. Well, mate, continue doing what you're doing, which is fantastic. I'm very proud of you. Keep going. We want to hear more.
Thank you, Gavin.
David Stereo in real life. And
thank you.
And thank you so much for your time today, mate.
Thanks, Gavin.
Gavin Wood's Countdown Podcast was thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating live.